Culture Affidavit, episode 154. Off-brand Robotech? Hello and welcome to episode 154 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panneries. So back in episode 76, you heard me and Donovan Morgan Grant talk about Robotech, the seminal anime franchise that aired on syndicated television in the afternoon during the 1980s, was rerun on Cartoon Network in the 90s, and has a pretty long legacy as far as our pop culture is concerned. Robotech, as we know it, consisted of three generations of anime series, the most well-known of which was Macross, featuring the characters Rick Hunter, Lin-Minmay, Lisa Hayes, and the battles between the SDF-1 and the Zentradi invasion forces. Building off all of that were The Masters, starring Dana Sterling, the child of Max and Miria Sterling from the Macross series, and The New Generation, which starred a ragtag group of wayward warriors led by Scott Bernard, who were trying to expel the Invid from the Earth. There were more series beyond that, most notably The Sentinels, which was a sequel to Macross, and a number of comic books and tie-in novels. But did you know that there was a fourth Robotech story that had nothing to do with anything I just mentioned? Robotech Defenders never had a cartoon, and at best, people remember it from a DC Comics miniseries, so it's never been more than an obscure curiosity in the world of Robotech or 80s cartoons and toys. I happened to find that miniseries at my LCS for very little money a little while back, so I thought I'd do a little digging and see if there was anything aside from that miniseries and why it was even associated with the brand Robotech. And what I found was, well, honestly, it's not that much, but it still is kind of a random curiosity. Whereas the classic Robotech comics from Comico have their origins in the cartoon that was adapted from Macross and the other two anime series, Robotech Defenders begins with Revell, the company that is one of the leading manufacturers of model kits, and back when I was younger, it would be all over toy and hobby stores. They had licenses for a number of properties, but also were well known for creating models of sports cars, fighter planes, battleships, and even the space shuttle. I actually had the space shuttle model, and I put it together when I was younger. It was a bit of a disaster, if I'm being honest. I am not a very good model builder. Anyway, the company's still around. I don't think it commands as much retail space as it used to, but back in 1984, it still had a solid presence and licensed Fang of the Sun Dugrum, which was a 75-episode anime television series created by Ryusuke Takahashi and Sunrise and aired in Japan from October 23, 1981 to March 25, 1983 on TV Tokyo. A 1983 full-length feature film, Dugrum, Documentary of the Fang of the Sun, summarized the series, and the model lines released in 1984 into the American market is concurrent with the release of the Transformers, who were hugely popular around the same time. Revell released these models that they created based on Fang of the Sun Dugrum under the brand name of Robotech, and they called them Defenders, putting them out concurrently with a line called Robotech Changers that were based on Super Dimensional Fortress Macross, that anime that would become with what we associate with Robotech. There was also a Robotech Factory model, and you can see it on a webpage from Caridian.net, which I'll link to in the show notes. From what I gather, the cool thing about the Changers line is that they can actually transform into the various iterations of the Valkyrie fighters and various other ships. There were SDF-1 models as part of the line, but they weren't Changers. Instead, there was a Storm Attacker mode, SDF-1, and a Cruiser mode. So the two formations of the SDF-1 were available in two separate models. Those SDF-1 models go for quite a bit on eBay these days. at least more than I'm willing to ever pay. But the Valkyrie models can be acquired for $20 or $30, depending on who's selling. And there seems to be quite a few that are still in the original packaging. The Defenders, on the other hand, were different. They did not change, but they did have movable parts, so it was almost like you were assembling and painting your own toys. They were, according to the Wikipedia entry for the Defenders, pretty challenging for even experienced model builders. And for all the weird association with Robotech, they actually sold fairly well in North America because a number of the models corresponded with the Battletech role-playing game, which itself took some of its models from the Dugrum anime. And you know what? There was actually even a television commercial.
You have come here for a special assignment, to assemble the Robotech force. Each robot will function differently. Some have rotating lasers, variable articulators, control modules, advanced weapon systems, digital warheads. These differences will destroy the enemy, for in the world of the enemy, all is the same.
This was only a Robotech test. In an actual emergency...
Robotech models, the mission to assemble them is yours.
Honestly, I think that's the only commercial for model kits that I've ever seen. And I don't remember seeing it on television either, but then again, I was like 6 or 7 years old at the time, so, you know, my memory on that would be shoddy as it is. But for the most part, I used to see ads for Revell and Ertl models in comic books, some of which had order forms, so you could order them through the comic book by tearing it out and ruining your comic. But, and the history, you know, the history of all of the Robotech stuff, though, gets pretty complicated. Because at first, Revell's licensing of the name prevented Harmony Gold, and that's the company that produced the Robotech cartoon, from releasing merchandise. Harmony Gold and Revell eventually came to an agreement that produced all of the stuff under the Robotech name. Now, of course, Harmony Gold would have issues with its toy line because of Hasbro using the Valkyrie model for the Transformer character Jetfire. Matchbox did eventually release a line of Robotech toys with figures and vehicles, although the Valkyrie was only available as a fighter and couldn't transform. I have fond memories of the Robotech line. I did have like one vehicle. I had the Scott Bernard motorcycle. It didn't transform either, but it did fit a G.I. Joe figure. I had a Rick Hunter figure at one point too, but I don't think the Robotech line was as popular or as loved as Transformers, G.I. Joe, or even the Voltron action figure stuff that came out in the mid-80s. Incidentally, Battletech, which I've mentioned before, was produced by Fassar, F-A-S-A, and they were sued by Harmony Gold in the 90s for an unauthorized use of Macross images in their role-playing game modules. They were eventually removed from the game. Now, if you want a Robotech Defenders model, you can definitely get them on eBay for various prices. I'm seeing ones that go for as low as $25 and as far as high as $100. And I guess for a 40-year-old model kit, that's not too bad. But what about the comic book, which is the first place I ever remember seeing Robotech Defenders, and probably what many of us might associate with Robotech Defenders if we've ever heard of it? Well, I'm going to look at that after this.
When you talk about comics, does it sound something like this?
Look, you can't put the Superman number 77s with the 200s. They haven't even discovered red kryptonite yet. And you can't put the number 98 with the 300s. Lori Lamaris hasn't even been introduced.
Or maybe it sounds a little more like this.
You think Mighty Mouse could beat up Superman? What are you, cracked? Why not? I saw the other day he was carrying 5 elephants in one hand.
Boy, you don't know nothing. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Superman is a real guy. No way a cartoon could beat up a real guy.
Yeah, maybe you're right. It would be a good fight, though.
Hello, I am the constantly caffeinated Clinton Robinson, and my comics discussions can go to both extremes, but generally fall somewhere in between. On the Coffee and Comics podcast, I will review comic stories and other comics-related topics that can be enjoyed over a cup of coffee. So pour the coffee, or other beverage of choice, and join me on the Coffee and Comics podcast, available on iTunes and coffeeandcomicspodcast.blogspot.com.
So before I get into the details and the summary of the DC Comics series, I want to give music credit for this episode. It is the music that used at the beginning and end of the episode is called Giant Robot by Go Genre Everything. And you can find the track at freemusicarchive.org. I will link to it in the show notes as well. Robotech Defenders was a planned three-issue miniseries that eventually became a two-issue miniseries in October and November of 1984. The Comico Robotech series would come out in November of 1984, with the first issue being called Macross, and it was rebranded as Robotech the Macross Saga with issue number two. Incidentally, these two Robotech Defenders comics came out at the same time as issues three and four of Marvel's original four-issue Transformers limited series. I first encountered Robotech Defenders, the comic, back in the early 90s. A new comic shop had opened not too far away from my then LCS, and I went there to check out what they had. I think I was only in there once. I am not even sure if I bought anything. And like a number of other comic stores that popped up during the speculation era, they closed pretty quickly. But as I was flipping through the back issue bins, I saw an issue of the Robotech Defenders miniseries. I had no idea that it existed. I had no idea what it was, and I had no idea if it had any connection to Robotech, which I had remembered watching and liking as a kid. Now, this is before, by the way, I got back into the idea of Robotech because Borders hadn't opened yet, and when Borders opened, I discovered the Jack McKinney novels in the sci-fi section. They were about $5 a pop, and as I went through my senior year of high school, I managed to buy all of them. Well, at least the first 12, and eventually bought the rest of them. I devoured those books, and I absolutely loved them. Anyway, I didn't give Robotech Defenders much thought after that, although I would always be a bit curious whenever I saw it, either in a cheap bin or mentioned in another DC comic of the time. A few months ago, I was flipping through the back issue bins at my LCS, mostly looking for those last two or three Atari Force comics, and I guess because it was on my mind, I decided to see if they had the Robotech Defenders book. And for 99 cents an issue, I picked it up. And you'll probably say I paid too much. And I will say that the cover to number one is weirdly stapled, so it looks like it has a rolled spine, even though it doesn't. But 99 cents per issue is still better than what I'm seeing on eBay. I mean, people have slabbed these issues, and right now they're asking for $199 for a 9.8 graded copy of number one. Oh, I'm sorry, $199.99. And I see a copy of number two with a 9.8 CGC grading for $159.99. Really? Look, if you like slabbing comics, that's your thing. The closest I ever got to them, I have these hard plastic cases. They open up and out, so they're meant to be opened. But I have them, and I can't remember what I paid for them, maybe like $10 or something like that. I bought them to keep some key issues in, like my New Teen Titans number two is in one of those, so it wasn't just in a bag or board. But again, $10, and I didn't have to send them to CGC, and if I wanted to read the issue, I could, even though I already have it in trade, so that's why I did that. Still, slabbing this, that's a sickness. And if you buy a $200 copy of this, you got screwed. Okay, that's mean, I know, but really? Slabbing this? Anyway, that all said and done, let's get into those comics and review them. Robotech Defenders number one was the first of what was billed as a three-part miniseries, and it came out in October of 1984 with the January 1985 cover date. The title of the story is The Gathering, and the creative team is Andrew W. Helfer, writer, Judith Hunt, penciler, Murphy Anderson, and Dan Zolovich, inkers, Ben Oda, letters, Bob LaRose, colors, and the editor was Barry Marks. Now, I'd obviously heard of more than a few of these people. Murphy Anderson, for instance, Ben Oda, who had lettered a lot of Teen Titans comics from back in the day. But I did have to look up Judith Hunt. She had about 4 years with her credits from 84 to 88. This included Comico's Evangeline series, several issues of Conan the King, and a couple of issues of American Flag, as well as a Marvel Fanfare issue. Her only other DC credit, by the way, is the Losers special. That was the one that was a Crisis crossover in 1985. Barry Marx's editorial credits include one of the Superpowers series from the 80s, as well as a number of trade paperbacks through the late 80s. And of course, Andrew Helfer had a pretty long career at DC. We open on a scene of war, and the narration boxes tell us that for all the people of Zoltek, an end to war is fast approaching. It comes swooping out of the skies, determined to deliver its singular deadly message. Nothing, least of all, a tiny fighter squadron can stop it. For the innocent people of Zoltek, the war will soon be over, but for Robotech defenders, the war is about to begin! I want to say Zoltek is the planet from some alien conspiracy series that Chris Honeywell used to run a clip of at the end of some of his episodes of TTF, but I'm not 100% sure. So the battle described in that narration, that dramatic narration, is raging. It's raging between a small group of fighters who are led by two people named Malik and Deck, and they are fighting against a giant battlecruiser that is from the alien race known as the Greylons. The squad gets some good shots in, but the Greylon battlecruiser ultimately is able to launch a missile that destroys the city they're trying to defend. The only thing left standing among the ruins is the ancient colossus of Zoltek. Malik, who we later see as a blonde human, tells the squad to land near the colossus, much to the dismay of Dax, her human male counterpart. The rest of the squad is made up of United Planets of Benetton cast, various colors and alien races who are part of an alliance that has been fighting for a long war against the Greylons. A frustrated Malik goes off on her own to brood and then thinks about how this has all started. The United World Confederation had welcomed the Greylons in peace and had voted to give them resources to improve their planet. However, the Greylons were interested in invading other worlds and killed a number of UWC ambassadors. The situation was put under control, and the Greylons went away from till a couple of weeks ago when they showed up with a vengeance and have now wiped out a number of planets, including Zoltek. As she thinks, Malik discovers that the Colossus's stone is crumbling, and that the stone is actually a facade. There's metal underneath, and she finds a door. She goes inside and discovers that the ancient Colossus of Zoltek is not a statue, but it's a huge robot. And once she's in the pilot's seat, she shakes off all the stones, scaring the crap out of her squad, and the robot telepathically teaches her not only how to fly it, but where there are other six robots like it. She tells the squad what she's found and then flies up into space to attack the Greylon ship. She is not successful, but she does survive and returns to the surface of the planet. She then tells the others about the six additional robots, and all of the robots are conveniently on the homeworlds of these six other people, and they all agree to help and fly off to those worlds. So, as our squad takes off to their homeworlds to find their robots, we first see Edon, a brown-skinned alien who finds his robot in an Amazon-like jungle. Skal, on his homeworld of Thorin, finds his on a mountain. The pterodactyl-like Arkos finds a robot buried in the deserts of his home planet of Kondar. The polar bear-like Isaac finds his buried in the ice of his Hoth-like world of Zion. Zion, Z-I-Y-O-N, Zion. And on the water world of Aqualo, Silky, a green-skinned female amphibious creature, finds hers. Finally, Dex finds his in a junkyard in his home planet of Gartan. The Greylons find out about the robots, and they panic. Then we get an idea who's really in charge. A race called the Salandre, who are using the Greylons as their army to conquer worlds. And the Salandre have the classic DC Comics thing of an apostrophe between the first couple of letters of their names. S apostrophe L-A-N-D-R-A-I. Salandre. Anyway, they give the Greylons a new, more powerful battleship, one that can level a planet. And the Greylons take off for Zoltek, which is where the squad has gathered. When the Greylons arrive, the squad scrambles to their robots and are suddenly outnumbered by hundreds of terrain stalkers. Malik correctly states, "I think we're in trouble." To be continued. Issue number 2 of what was supposed to be that 3-issue miniseries is now issue number 2 of a 2-part miniseries. It boasts that the book is 32 pages and has no ads, but it does keep its 75-cent cover price. There's an editor's note on the inside front cover, and it says, "By now you've undoubtedly noticed that the Robotech Defenders 3-issue miniseries has become the Robotech Defenders 2-issue miniseries. We apologize to all those who are expecting 3 issues, but for reasons too numerous to mention, we decided to complete the series in 2 issues. Since these were the circumstances, we felt that the best compromise would be to give you more for your money at no sacrifice to the story or the artwork. So, here's the dynamic conclusion of the Robotech Defenders saga, told in 32 pages without commercial interruption, all for a mere 75 cents. And as an extra bonus, the issue features 2 brand new covers, front and back. Enjoy." By the way, the back cover, I'm pretty sure, was supposed to be the cover of issue 2, with the front cover being the cover, what I think was supposed to be issue 3, because it says, "The Final Confrontation." There's also an inside of the back cover, a shot of the Robotech Defenders sitting around a campfire with their robots in the background. It looks like a firework going off or something, or explosion in the sky. So, there you go. Anyway, credits on number 2 are Andrew Helfer, writer, Judith Hunt, and Mike Manley, pencilers. And I have to point out that this is Mike Manley's first ever comic book credit. He'd go on to pencil Batman during the Night Quest, Night's End, Prodigal era. He actually currently pencils, does the art on Judge Parker, or I think Judge Parker, which is a comic strip. The inkers were Murphy Anderson and Dan Zollner, Rich Benno Oda-Lettered, Nancy Houlihan now colored, and Barry Marks, of course, was the editor. The title of this issue is The Confrontation, although based on the next issue blurb at the end of issue 1, I think issue 2 was originally supposed to be The Awakening, and issue number 3 was supposed to be probably The Confrontation. Anyway, we open right where we left off with Malik telling her team to get ready to fight this massive army of robots. It doesn't go well. They get a few hits in, but they're overrun and all the robots are captured. Silky is unconscious and maybe even dead. While they're being loaded into the big Greylon ship, Malik notices a red button that has all of a sudden started to glow. She presses it and the robot takes over, freeing itself. She radios for the others to do so, and 5 of the 6 other robots free themselves as well. Once they get away, the robots start talking to the crew. They actually once were organic beings, engineers from the planet Technor, and had sought to help the Salandre until they discovered that the Salandre were energy parasites. To survive, the engineers transferred their minds into the bodies of these robots, and collectively they call themselves the Robotech Defenders. They scattered themselves across the universe and went doormat until the day was needed for them to rise again. And guess what? That day has come. The Defenders also explained that the reason the Greylons are involved in all this is that the Salandre are actually very weak. They need a proxy army to do their battles. Therefore, they entered into a pact with the Greylons. At this moment, a Greylon general named Saiba pops out from behind the rock and explains that a pact was made for the Greylons to conquer other planets for the Salandre. And then they would be allowed to take over one of those worlds for their own. Saiba becomes an unlikely ally because he and the Robotech Defenders realize that if the Salandre unlock the secrets of Aquilo, who's the captured defender, they will almost be impossible to stop. So they create a ruse where the general will pretend to have captured Dex and will bring him to the Greylon's home planet. It works. The Greylon leader, who is plotting against the Salandre anyway, tells Dex to activate the Defender so that they can learn its secrets. However, the Greylons don't know about the big red button, and once Saiba pushes it, Aquilo comes to life and takes both Dex and Saiba to safety. The Salandre that is with the Greylons, there's only one of them, and he gets angry and kills all of them on the ship as well as the planet, and sends the energy he siphoned from them to his mothership that's all the way across the galaxy. The rest of his race wake up. And now it's a race against time to stop the Salandre from siphoning the energy and life from all of the Robotech Defenders' home planets. So they head off to destroy the siphon devices, and it does not go well at first, as it looks like 2 of the siphons are successful. Saiba pilots the Aquilo Defender, and as he is piloting it, he comes across the Salandrian mothership, which has now moved into their galaxy. He calls the other Defenders to regroup on the water planet and battle that mothership. They fight and then come up with an idea to send the energy of the sun into the mothership so that they can overload it to the point where the ship explodes. They do that. The defenders head back to Zoltek to regroup. Later, Malak tells the group of survivors from Zoltek that the defenders were successful and now it's time to put their worlds back together by themselves. But the defenders say that they will help because there are many more of them throughout the galaxy. And one of them points to a star in the sky saying, "Look to that star, so small, so seemingly insignificant, but our brothers sleep there too. One day they will be needed, and on that day the Robotech defenders will rise again. And that star, well, it's our sun." And the last panel shows Earth. The end. Is it mean of me to say that the most interesting thing in these two issues was Dick Giordano's Meanwhile column at the end of issue one, which was Justice League of America versus the Avengers, The Death of a Dream? Okay, that is mean. The thing is, this comic series isn't terrible. I mean, it's not some steaming pile of crap that becomes a punchline for smartasses like myself to drag it whenever they feel like it. So basically, it's not Brigade. But it's not particularly a good comic either. What you have here is by the numbers tie-in for a C-list product. Now, Revell's products were always good. They still are, as far as I know. They're still going pretty strong as a company. But the Transformers had actual toys, as well as a cartoon. Robotech Defenders was just a line of models that clearly had a niche audience. And I'm thinking that this was probably an effort by Revell to get out of that niche, but it falls flat. And again, I'm not being all like, look at these morts and stuff like that. It's not even a unintentionally hilarious sort of awful like Megaforce or something. It's just kind of a forgettable comic series. As a concept, it could work. You have a reptilian alien race that's invading other worlds with a secret, all-powerful other group of aliens behind them, all of whom the Salandre look like Emperor Palpatine. Then you have seven robots who each come from a different type of terrain or geographical area: city, ocean, mountain, desert, jungle, ice, and, well, I guess Zoltek's supposed to be rural or something. I didn't quite catch it on the Listen to the Land ride at Epcot. Anyway, much like, say, Voltron, the people discover the robots and awaken them from their slumber to fight the evil power. So when you look at this on paper, it makes sense, right? But the problem is, there's nothing to suggest that the premise needs to be this way. Each of the defenders looks different, but essentially does the same thing. It's not like the polar defender shoots ice and the ocean one has a water cannon or something. They all shoot lasers. They don't form a bigger robot or anything like that. And plus, none of the characters on the Defender Squad are actually developed. We see where they come from, but it's not like you have the hothead and the leader and the tech wizard and the ninja and the kid or anything. They just seem to match up with their robots. And then there's a fight. And the robots themselves, while I'm sure they were fun to put together as models, didn't look particularly cool, at least when compared to other robot-based toys of the time. I mean, Macross has like those F-14-looking planes that transform, right? They also have cool alien ships like the Battleroids and stuff like that. Voltron, they have lions and they have vehicles. The Transformers, well, there were the Transformers. You've seen the Transformers. So a bunch of robots that look slightly different from one another and all had guns, they just weren't going to compete. Robotech Defenders is kind of the Voltron 2 of Robotech. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, check out a blog post I wrote from back in 2010 that explains what Voltron 2 is. But what about these comics, these issues? Well, saying they're not terrible is damning them with faint praise, I realize, but the stories vary by the numbers. It's the sort of, oh, the kids will like this type of stuff to sell toys. It's the type of thing that maybe somebody who knew you like comics would buy and you'd flip through, but you'd just lose or forget you had and maybe find it in a drawer years later. I mean, the whole thing is very Mattel Mars Chocobot Hour.
The new approved kids news has been canceled. Stay tuned for the Mattel and Mars Bar Quick Energy Chocobot Hour.
You can count on us, Mr. President. Major Nougat, Gooey, Coco, put down those entertaining Mattel products. Colonel Katappi is up to his old tricks.
Let's power up! I can't believe they canceled us for this.
Shut up! I'm trying to watch this.
Chocolate away!
Andrew Helfer, who had a long career at DC as both a writer and an editor, was at the very beginning of that career at this point. And prior to this, he'd actually had an issue of Unexpected and a couple of issues of Atari Force, as well as a Supergirl PSA comic about seatbelts that was done in conjunction with Honda. He'd also written the first of the Which Way Superman books. Which Way, by the way, was a choose-your-own-adventure type of book. And here he does what he's supposed to do. While the characters aren't particularly compelling, the story at least makes for a good comic. Alien invaders, a team of heroes with their backs against the wall, discovery of a secret weapon, and the revelation of who's really behind everything. Plus, what is lacking in characterization is made up for with the action. For being only a couple of issues, it's paced well, and I appreciate that discovering the Robotech Defenders doesn't mean the good guys automatically win. In fact, they're captured, beaten, one of them dies. I'm pretty sure of that anyway. All I know is that at some point we see the Water Defender get shot down and captured, and we see Silky unconscious in the cockpit. Malik says they sustained a casualty, but by the time they rescue the Defender, Silky's nowhere to be seen, and it's Saiba who pilots it for the rest of the series. So, she's dead, and they never recover the body? There's no funeral? They just forget that she's there? It's really, really weird. She's gone. Anyway, the plot contrivance that is the magic red button that wakes up the autonomous defenders, in other words, they have the easy button from Staples, is clearly a what if the Voltron Lions were alive like the Transformers, but they also had human pilots type of thing. It's also really convenient because it gets them out of trouble. And you see that all the time on after school cartoons, right? But at least with here, the way they get rid of the bad guys makes sense. You know, those aliens are energy vampires, so they realize that purposely overloading them with energy will destroy them. And I guess had the miniseries worked, we would have gotten a sequel that took place on Earth. Maybe we can work this into Macross continuity and say the SDF-1 was the Defender that... I don't even think Titan Comics could get that to work at this point. Anyway, the idea that Earth might be next is an interesting one. If the book had been a hidden gem, I would have wondered how they were going to do this, but it's not a hidden gem, so I really don't care. The art, by the way, saves just about everything. Judith Hunt and Mike Manley, as well as their anchors, do a really good job, and it's on par with what you were seeing in both G.I. Joe and the Transformers at the time. Sure, these two weren't marquee artists or anything like that back in the early 1980s, but this also isn't giving work to someone who is just going to half-ass it either. I like Mike Manley's work on Batman. In fact, I think he's one of the more underrated Batman artists of that era. I like Judith Hunt's artwork here as well. The characters all do have specific looks. They do their best with the robots. The aliens do look menacing enough, and the battle scenes are dynamically rendered. If I have any quibble with the way the comic looks, it's that the books were printed on the Mondo paper using the flexographic printing process, and the coloring just looks terrible. And it's not a knock against the two, Bob LaRose or Nancy Houlihan. It's just the way it was printed. Because I have a number of comics from this time, and I don't know if I've come across a single one that was really improved by this printing process. I know that they pretty much got rid of it eventually. Granted, I will also complain time to time about the Baxter books, but in case the Baxter books, the problem was with them was that they wound up highlighting the artist's flaws. The Mondo paper and flexographic process just made things look like everything had been misprinted. Like color splotches and like things look slightly off and outside the lines. Anyway, despite Revell's best efforts, and hey, there was even an ad for the Robotech Force models in the back cover issue number one, this went nowhere, to the point where they couldn't even get their original run of three issues in. Now, while the one site I found about the Robotech Defenders mentioned that the book was unpopular and the reason the book was shrunk to two issues was low sales, I want to say the other reason the book was shrunk down was because of the television series and the Comico comic. I mentioned earlier that the first Comico Robotech comic premiered just as the second issue of Robotech Defenders was on the stands. But this is kind of interesting, at least at a glance. The Comico book is not even called Robotech at first. It's simply titled Macross. The Robotech title wouldn't actually start until the second issue, and that issue wouldn't come out until April of 85, and that's a month after the Robotech cartoon premiered on syndicated television. So what I think DC had to do was that they had to wrap up the Defenders series quickly, not just because it was unpopular, but because of Harmony Gold's plans to release the cartoon and their licensed stuff and whatever deal they cut with Revell. So Revell had to offload any tie-ins to the Defenders, but maybe they were still allowed to produce the models. I mean, this is conjecture on my part. I wasn't able to really find any information about this. If anybody knows otherwise, let me know. So, my verdict on Robotech Defenders, not a hidden gem. It's probably not even worth grabbing if you come across it on the cheap. Like I said, it's not horrible, but my curiosity was only satisfied with a shrug, and the whole series winds up being a footnote in the history of DC Comics licensed property books. I paid $2 for the series. Yes, I mean, you might think I overpaid, but at least I didn't purchase the slab copy for $200. Anyway, that'll do it. I'll be back in June with another episode, and we'll be turning my attention toward music, as one of my favorite albums of all time turns 40. Until then, thanks very much for listening, and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is produced by me, Tom Panarese. All clips are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast is a part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you can find at twotruefreaks.com. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show get noticed by other people. Feedback via email can be sent to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. For show notes and essays and other things random in the world of popular culture, visit popcultureaffidavit.com. You can also follow this show on Facebook at facebook.com/popcultureaffidavit and on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. Thanks for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.